You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Hello and welcome to this interview of the Lotus Eaters. I'm your host, Stelios, and I have the honor and pleasure to be joined by Professor Stephen Hicks. Professor Hicks, welcome.
Thanks for the invitation. Happy to be here.
I'm very happy to be talking to you. And I think we have plenty of topics to talk about.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yes. huge amount going on in philosophy and its spillovers into the cultural sphere. So we will fill up the time.
Exactly. So first question I would like to ask you is, what interested you in philosophy from the beginning? What made you want to become an academic?
Well, in that sense, I think I was a late bloomer. When I was in my teen years and into my early 20s, I planned on being an architect and civil engineer. So most of my thinking was in that direction. Although from an early age, I always was a reader and I loved fiction and history and ideas of various sorts. I had no idea what philosophy was as a discipline until I went to university. And there I was just taking a variety of courses to understand the landscape and to learn a bunch of stuff before I planned to have a more technical and artistic career as an architect in engineering. But in my first year of university, I was reading and taking courses. And what often happens in the first year of university is a whole world opens up to one. And that was the year that philosophy as a discipline came together in my mind. I understood what it was, and I was fascinated, and I ended up taking a large number of courses in philosophy, but still planning to go to engineering and architecture. So it wasn't until I was 23 or 24, and I'd run out of money after graduated, so I was working in construction, that I was continuing to take, you know, math and science courses to prepare for engineering. But at the same time, I was also still doing a lot of reading in philosophy. So I went back and forth for a while about where I wanted to do. And then at this point, I was in Canada, but I made a decision, you know, I really like philosophy. So I applied to a bunch of graduate schools in the United States, ended up coming to the States to get my PhD degree. And I was serious about it, but at the same point, I was always thinking, you know, well, if it doesn't work out, because the, you know, getting a job as a philosophy professor and getting through the academic world even then was quite challenging. My fallback was to go back to architecture and engineering, but thing worked out, and I've been very happy spending my time doing philosophy for some decades now.
This is great, and. I think that it's a very interesting way of going into philosophy, because you sort of come from a STEM background, a very engineering background, and you sort of fell in love with a philosophical discipline, it seems.
Yeah, that's right.
So
let me just add one more thing. It was the STEM, but the architecture side, I don't want to underplay that, because the aesthetic and the design elements, I think one of the things was appealing is, you know, that with the STEM knowledge and the aesthetic, element that comes from architecture. You are creating the world that you would like to be a part of. So there is also a big value component that integrates.
Exactly. So I want to ask you about academia right now, because it seems to me that right now academia in the West isn't particularly healthy. And there are several facets of the culture war that stem from academia. Now, would you say that this is an accurate assessment? And if so, how did we get here?
Yes. I would say, yes, overall, yes, that is an accurate assessment. We are going through one of the great soul-searching times for higher academics. And the liberal education project on which most modern universities have been based for more than a century now has been severely tested for the last generation or two by strongly illiberal philosophies of education. And much of that then has spilled out to outside of the academic world, so which is why everyone is aware of what's going on there. So I say overall, though, I do want to say that we have to very quickly start breaking universities down, because universities are big institutions with multiple aspects. So if you talk about the humanities areas, that's where I think most of the sickness is. And I'm using that concept of sickness. We can unpack that. In the social sciences, things are also severely tested, and there are serious problems there, but also some signs of health. As we get into the natural sciences, things are much healthier. The professional schools, medicine, business, and education, I think we have to break those down and talk about them separately. So the universities need to be broken down into their constituent elements. That's just to speak of the academic side. Another big part of the discussion has to be about what's going on in the administration, what's going on in HR departments, what's happening in fundraising departments, what's happening among deans and presidents and other administrators as well. And there, I think it is, again, a mixed case, but the dynamic is slightly different as well. So we can plunge in wherever you like.
Okay, so I would like to ask you about the intellectual as well as the administrative aspects of the sickness, as you call it. Professor Hicks, what do you think are the current intellectual dimensions of the current state of academia in the West?
Well, I'm a philosopher by training, and I do think that this is fundamentally a philosophical debate. Modern universities, or in the United States, Canada, where I am from, in the broadly English-speaking world, and to a significant extent on the European continent, in the modern world, we're guided by the idea that education should be training individuals to think for themselves about a wide range of issues. That if you are going to be a functional individual in the modern world, not only do you need to be literate, but you need to know something about economics and politics and religion and science and technology. And so one should have this broad-based education. At the same time, one should not simply be someone who is parroting what one's teachers or professors are saying, that you need to be an active participant in the democratic process, to be a Republican citizen, to be able to make your own way economically in the world, to work out your own philosophy and or religion of life, to understand technological systems and scientific systems and so on. And so the education is not simply a matter of content, but also training one's mind to be able to think like a free-thinking person in all of these areas. So the idea of a university then is that students are going to get a broad-based education in this content and in the methodology. And that the professors themselves, since we are, as moderns, are recognizing that we don't necessarily have all of the answers, that we are open-ended with respect to science and technology and improving the human condition, that at the forefront of knowledge, the professors themselves are going to have different theories and be arguing with each other. And it's healthy for students then to enter into those debates, and themselves even to be able to debate and question their professors. Now, all of that ethos and the philosophy underlying it led to a huge explosion in higher education in the 1900s, the 2000s, and most universities and liberal arts colleges were founded on that basis. Now, there was, though, a philosophical counter-revolution that started after World War II, just to choose one significant date. Obviously, the world is largely focused on other things as these world wars are going on and the Depression and so on. But after World War II in particular, you see the beginnings of a serious counter-revolution in all of the traditional now liberal arts institutions. Because what had happened was many Central European intellectuals had gotten out of Europe due to the rise of the Nazis in the 1930s and the terrible things happening in Central Europe and the war in the 1940s. Many of them, even though their sympathies politically were with various kinds of Marxism and neo-Marxism, did not want to stay in Eastern Europe after the Soviets took that part over. So there was a big exodus of not only intellectuals, but lots of creative people from Eastern Europe and Central Europe to the West, and they brought a certain set of ideas with them. At the same time, in the Western world, philosophy was had reached a relatively skeptical point by the time we get to the 1950s. And many of the extreme skeptical movements philosophically started then to rethink the nature of philosophy and the nature of education as a result, if we are increasingly skeptical. And so what we call postmodernism, Lyotard's famous phrase about being skeptical about meta-narratives, for example. So the idea that somehow through reason and science and so forth, we can come to understand big picture views of the world and use that technologically and in the social sciences and in the humanities to improve the human condition, was a profoundly skeptical time. And so what we find is what we call postmodernism, a skepticism about the Enlightenment as a whole and everything downstream from that comes to be prominent. And the names that are most associated with this, deservedly so, are thinkers like Michel Foucault, Jacques Derrida, and others. In the 1960s, they rise relatively quickly to the top of their profession. They become extraordinarily influential, not only in philosophy, but in the humanities more broadly and in several of the social sciences. They succeed in capturing some departments and graduating a large number of people who become professionals in law, in business, in the arts, and other cultural spheres. Until by the time we get to the 1990s, it's quite clear that the traditional liberal arts idea of the university and education is under attack, that it has a formidable challenger. And so the debate then for the last generation inside the academic world has been over those who are broadly enlightenment and committed to liberal education and those who philosophically and deeply are opposed to every element of that. By the time we get to 2010, 2015 or so, another generation, that's now two generations into, much of this is then spilling out from the higher education world into other cultural spaces, into education, mainstream education, into the political sphere, into the artistic sphere, and so on. And suddenly everybody is aware of this big battle culturally that we are having, but the roots of it are inside the academic world, and particularly by philosophers. Just add a point here that Foucault and Derrida and Lyotard and Richard Rorty, the American postmodernists, all of them are PhDs in philosophy, and they are mounting fundamentally philosophical attacks on the Enlightenment and downstream of it, liberal education. So that's where I think we are in a nutshell.
So let me summarize and tell me if you think that I summarize correctly what I take to be your point. Liberal education was the dominant model, and the dominant model suggested that education should be about teaching students how to think and how to have a well-rounded education rather than just being very specialized and losing the big picture, and also being citizens.
Yes.
And we have lost this due to several reasons, because we have come to a position where students are being told what to think. Most professors, particularly those who are propagating these ideas, are posing as supreme moral authorities that cannot be challenged, without challenging them being a sort of hate speech. And we are led into this idea of illiberal and counter-enlightenment education. Is that roughly correct?
That's roughly correct. I would just to back off a little bit from that, we have lost this. I'd say right now inside the academic world, the debate is engaged and it is quite vigorous. There's a significant number of people inside the academic world who are still Enlightenment thinkers, broadly speaking. I think this is why, you know, those of us who follow the public intellectual realm, we all know the name Steven Pinker. We all know the name Jonathan Haidt. We all know the name Jordan Peterson. And all of them are representative of different parts of the political spectrum. But nonetheless, they are committed to Enlightenment values and liberal education. So inside the academic world, with those three individuals especially assuming a kind of leadership role, we are fighting. I don't want to say quite tooth and nail, although in some cases it comes close to that, to figure out what we want universities to be now. So the battle is not lost, but it is engaged, and in some cases it is vicious. And some subsections of the university, some departments, some programs have been, in fact, lost.
Okay, I want to ask you a question here that I don't hear people asking, because there's a lot of focus on the continental philosophy traditions, like critical theory, deconstructionism, and the masters of suspicion that I think Paul Ricoeur was talking about, Marx, Nietzsche, and Freud. I think I rarely listen to people asking about the elements within analytic philosophy that could be corrosive. And by being corrosive, I don't mean that they could lead into the practices and ways of teaching that we encounter in the other tradition, but create indirect problems. So, for instance, you mentioned Jonathan Haidt and Steven Pinker. I don't know to what extent this is an issue with Jordan Peterson, but it seems to me that one of the major problems in late 20th century philosophy and the main worldview is that the dominant worldview is something akin to scientism. Now, this may be wrong, but tell me if you think that there is such a dominant trend. There is a very interesting way in which I think that this leads into problems, and I have the impression that this leads to problems, especially with the points that Steven Pinker is raising, and also with Jonathan Haidt, it seems to me that they make several moral claims, but if at the end the background, the metaphysical background in which they situate these claims is a sort of materialism that boils down everything to matter in motion, I think that there are several problems with respect to how accounting for basic morality. Do you think that this is entirely mistaken, or maybe that it has a hint of truth?
Yes, it has a hint of truth, but you're raising kind of two generations, or possibly three generations of intellectual history and philosophical history. So I think you are right that when we talk about postmodernism and critical theory and the problems downstream that we are facing in higher education and the related cultural spaces, that most prominence is given to postmodernism and to Frankfurt School critical thinking. And both of those come out primarily of continental philosophical traditions. So, for example, if you take someone like Foucault or Derrida, both of them will point us back to people like Heidegger and Nietzsche, and they are in the continental tradition. And it is true that the philosophical world from, say, the 1700s, definitely by the time we get into the 1800s, was split into broadly Anglo and then American style of philosophy, and analytic philosophy largely came out of that tradition, and continental philosophy. And one way of characterizing the split was to say that continental philosophy was much more speculative, much more explicitly collectivizing, much more explicitly anti-rational. We have Kierkegaard and Nietzsche and Heidegger, and they're all anti-rational, and the language is impenetrable and hard to understand. And out of that, we have a kind of philosophical tradition. At the same time, coming out of the Anglo-American tradition, what we have is a philosophical tradition that goes back to people like Francis Bacon and John Locke and Isaac Newton, and it is a much more empirically oriented philosophical tradition. It's also been pro-reason, pro-scientific method, and so forth, that it prizes rigor, that it sees science as something progressive and technology as wonderful and so on. Now, what we then have by the time we get into the 1800s and on into the 1900s is what's going on in the philosophical world in terms of Anglo-American style, or more broadly now analytic philosophy, is quite different in its sympathies and its style from continental philosophy. So your first question, I think, is right to say, well, what about the analytic tradition? Why might we think that it also contributed to laying the groundwork in some way, the problems that we are having right now? So what I think happened to the analytic tradition, this is now using it as a very broad category, using it to include various schools like positivism and logical positivism and pragmatism and neo-pragmatism and linguistic analysis and so forth. And all of that needs to be parsed out a whole lot more. But by the time we got to the 1950s, clearly those were seen as dead ends, that the philosophers who were working in those traditions also became very skeptical. So we see this, for example, in the 1920s and on into the 1930s. So I'll just use as one example, A.J. Ayer publishes in 1936 a short book called Language, Truth, and Logic. And he is coming out of a tradition, Oxford philosophy, Cambridge philosophy, British philosophy, and then downstream to some extent, North American philosophy and Australian and New Zealand philosophy, is saying that language and logic are handmaidens to science, and they should be working with science to clarify all of science's conceptual vocabulary and its methodology so that the sciences can go on and do their work at figuring out the way the world works. But what you have in 1936, and notice this is getting close to World War II, though, is A.J. Ayer announcing where those trends have ended, that metaphysics is not only a weirdly speculative discipline of human thinking, but it literally is meaningless and we should stop doing it. That value theory and morality is not only hard to work out and it gets our emotions engaged and we have all of these debates, but that fundamentally moral philosophy is meaningless and we should stop doing it. And the same thing is true of religion and aesthetics as well. So what you have then by the time we get to the 1930s is to say that if we do our epistemology seriously, that is to say, we study language, we study all of the tools that philosophers use in all of these domains, that philosophy should not anymore be interested in metaphysics, in ethics, in religion, in art, that all of these are just non-rational, non-philosophical, meaningless disciplines, that there might be other psychological things that we do to study them, but philosophy is going to dismiss them from itself. So to put the language, this point rhetorically, what we then have is philosophy committing a kind of suicide and saying that huge sectors of the real estate of traditional philosophy are just completely meaningless and we're not going to do it. So what we are then left with then is really philosophy as maybe a handmaiden to science. But at the same time, if we then do our heavy duty philosophy, again, this is by the 1930s, we look at what the scientists do. Well, they would say, according to the empiricist model, they do observations of reality. But again, by the 1930s, the leading philosophers are saying our perceptual apparatus just gives us illusions. We can't tell the difference between a perception and a hallucination. Maybe we are all dreaming. Maybe we are all really stuck in Descartes' predicament. And we can't really say that our percepts are putting us in contact, much less accurate contact with reality. Scientists then want to say that they are using these various abstract concepts. But then where do these abstract concepts come from? And then the argument by the 1930s is that they seem to be conventional. They're just words that we make up, that we just arbitrarily make impositions on reality. And we can't think outside of the verbal framework that we are raising to say that our concepts have anything to do with reality. And then so forth with respect to all of the other elements of scientific method, that we are doing mathematics, that we are doing logic. Well, the thinkers, again, by the 1930s, working in this school, want to say, well, ultimately, logic and mathematics are just matters of arbitrary subjective definitions, and they don't give us any guidance to say that we're actually picking out something called a causal order out there in reality. So the point is that by the 1930s, also in the pro-science, positivist, logical positivist, analytic philosophy traditions, the philosophers are reaching very skeptical conclusions. And now there's the big interruption of the World War, but after the World War is over and we get into the 1950s and the 1960s, or late 1940s and on into the 1950s, things pick up again, and philosophy, even in the Anglo and American world, is in a very skeptical place. So if we are then focusing especially on the epistemology, our view of our minds in relation to reality, can we know the world? It's not only the Continentals that are highly skeptical, it's also those coming working in the Anglo-American tradition, that we need to just start talking about truth as something that pushes our value buttons, or that something that happens to work for us, but what works for us is ultimately subjective according to the individual or according to the group that we are raised in. And so philosophy has, so to speak, undercut all of its foundational presuppositions that had come down from the Enlightenment, and most philosophers are throwing up their hands and saying, we don't know what we are doing right now.
So what do you think of the administrative aspect of academia right now? Is there any kind of mismanagement? And if so, how do you think can it be fixed?
Well, yes, I think there's a few things here that we should say that are downstream from the intellectual, and other things that I think are not so polite about the administrative thing. In many cases, what we have in the administration is part the long march through the institution, that many people who want to transform in education, they don't like the liberal education model. They have some ideological framework that they believe in, but they recognize that if they're going to change higher education or even lower education, it's not only the faculty that is going to do that. That through student life, through the HR departments, through the various other administrative departments of a large university, if we can have people of our ideological stripe running the programs there, then we can change society in the directions that we want to go. So just to take one example, it's a fairly common practice for most universities to have an orientation week. So students, especially the first year students who are arriving on campus, to give them a week-long introduction to university life. And if you can have your people, so to speak, setting the program, what their students are going to read, what messages they're going to hear, what values they're going to be told that they should subscribe to in order to be good university students, if you can introduce your ideology into orientation week, then that is that's an important part of it as well. The other elements, though, that I think are perhaps less flattering is that many people who go into administration, who become deans, who then become provosts, are academics. And to put it bluntly, they are failed academics. That what they do is they start off as people who are interested in their field. They might get a degree in some field, they get their PhD, but they then become professors, and they realize after 5 to 7 years or so that they really don't like teaching very much, and perhaps they are not very good at it. Or they don't have very much to say, that they're not writers, they don't have any sort of interest or track record at getting things published. So there you are, and say you've got tenure and you're still relatively early in your career, but you don't like the idea of 20 or 30 more years of teaching, and you don't see any prospect for you over the course of the next 20 or 30 years making any sort of a mark as a writer and in terms of publications. So what you of course can do is what some professors do, is you kind of take early retirement. At that point, you just give up on things. You do the minimum to get through to retirement or whatever. But another option for you is to go into administration, to become an associate dean, to become a dean. Now, I don't want to generalize and say that all people who become deans and so on fit this pattern, but there is a significant number of them who for whom this is an absolutely true description of their career path. You get better money, you have a little bit more power. In some ways, you have less work to do, but you have a certain amount of less accountability in some respects. And so what you then have is basically B-level or C-level people who come to have a significant play in the administration as well. I think a third dynamic is that often when one goes into administration, one has a significant amount of committee work and paperwork and so forth to do. There is a rationality and there is a workload that is involved. And what one does not want is anything that's going to interfere with that. And so obviously deans and provosts have to be troubleshooters. The faculty are often fighting with each other. The students are doing this, that, and the other thing. That what you often want is for just problems to go away, so that they don't give the university a bad reputation, they don't take too much up your daily schedule and so on. And in many cases, a compromise on various sorts of principles is an easy way simply to make a problem go away. So if you have, for example, a student who is insisting that a given student did not perform adequately in order to get a passing grade. But that student, say, is a high-profile athlete, or that student is a representative of a certain ideological cause, and there's going to be huge publicity, bad publicity for you, and more problems and more headaches for you to solve down the road. It's easier in many cases for the deans or the provost to put pressure on the professor to change the grade, right, or to use some sort of administrative device against the professor's will to change the grade. That's just one small example. But the point just is that that's a significant portion of what happens on the administrative side as well, and they are contributing to the problems as well.
So basically, you would say that it is those who are least qualified members of staff usually get key positions of power. And would you also say that there is an element of politicization of the administrative positions? Because one of the key duties of those who administrate.
Both of those again, but with qualification. I would say, as with the faculty, there is a lively debate. Among the administration, you find many people who are very smart, who are very committed to principle. They want to advance their careers, right, of course, but nonetheless, they are doing a good job. The point just is that there are now, as a over the last two generations, an increasing number of people who can get a cushy job without particularly having strong, strong backbone or a strong mind. And there are a significant number of them who are politicized. So within the administration, there are the same debates.
And would you say that sometimes the universities become targets of political associations that want to infiltrate academia, not necessarily as members of staff, but in all sorts of ways, and try to use academia in order to spread a kind of message, usually a political one?
Well, for sure. I mean, any philosophy, if you are not just I'll use this a little pejorative, just say a Platonic philosopher who just is happy to be up in the ivory tower contemplating your idea of a perfect world. If your idea of philosophy is more Aristotelian or more practically oriented, that the purpose of doing philosophy is to live yourself a better life, but also to make the world a better place. So all of the theory needs to be translated into practice. Then at some point you are going to look at your society and then say, what will my philosophy mean for the key cultural sectors and the key institutions in my society? And every practically oriented philosophy ultimately does that. And so you look not only at the economic sphere, at the political sphere, at what's going on in religion, what's going on in families, but you do look at education. And you recognize that if philosophy is going to be successful, then you want young people from the earliest stage possible to come to adopt your philosophy so they can incorporate it into their lives as well. So philosophy and philosophy of education has always been an important spin-off as well. So then we just have is once your philosophy world has transformed itself from an old style philosophy, as they would then call it, into a new kind of philosophy, the new philosophers want to break down and reform or totally annihilate the old ones and build the institution anew on the basis of their new ideology. And there always are ideologists who are strategic about that. So they go into education with the idea of transforming the existing educational institution in the light of their new philosophical framework.
Thank you. I think we should go on the next section of our discussion, which is about post-liberalism and also the Russian philosopher Dugin. Now, it seems to me that right now there are a lot of people who flirt with the idea of post-liberalism. And the more I look into it, it doesn't seem to me to be introducing anything substantially new. This seems to me to be a sort of recreation of the language of communitarianism, of the communitarianism of people like Michael Sandel, Charles Taylor, and Alasdair MacIntyre. So would you say that this is an accurate assessment, or do you think that post-liberalism right now is sort of deviating from communitarianism?
No, I think there's a lot to what you just summarized. Excuse me for one moment. Thanks. Sorry about that. So if we take the liberalism component, now liberalism is partly a political philosophy that liberty or freedom should be the fundamental political value, and the job of governments is basically to protect people's liberties, and that other political values are important, but they're nested within a commitment to liberalism. Liberalism is also an ethos that individuals should think of themselves as free agents, as self-governing, that I am responsible for my life, my economic life, for participating politically, for making my romantic life work, for my religious views and so forth. That in all of these areas, I'm going to be a free agent and a free thinker. And then on the underlying epistemological elements, that I have free agency, what I believe, what I make commitments to, it's up to me, that I can assess the evidence, I can change my mind, I can adjust my beliefs. So there's kind of a liberalism all of the way down that can be a broad philosophical outlook. So what then happens among the post-liberals is if one is a philosopher or otherwise a deep thinking intellectual who comes to think that some or all of those elements of the broad liberal package are false or wrong or taking people in the wrong direction, then one will mount a critique of them and say we need to go beyond that or post that. And that comes in many forms. So one will say that it's not possible for individuals to be free agents cognitively, so to speak, that our minds are just conditioned by forces beyond our control and so on. So that then will take one in a post-liberal direction cognitively. Or one will say individuals are not moral agents and self-responsible for what they say and what they do. Rather, people are conditioned by or puppets of forces, again, beyond their control. So if you don't think that people are liberal moral agents, then you are going to understand people in a different direction. You will have a post liberal ethos. If you don't like the liberal political institutions, democracy and republicanism, and if you don't like its economic institution, you don't like free markets and capitalism, then what you will do is you will mount critiques of democracy, of republicanism, of free markets, capitalism, and so on, and go post in those areas as well. Now, what do you then replace that liberal philosophy and that liberal culture with? And again, there are several alternatives. And here we can say, this is now taking us directly to your question. Obviously, one form of post-liberalism has been postmodernism and critical theory. And these are people coming from the left, broadly speaking. Some of them are Marxists or neo-Marxists or neo-neo-Marxists or disillusioned Marxists who want to go off in significantly different directions. But what they are opposed to is the liberal package, and they want to take it in a more left-wing, anti-rational, collectivist direction. And some of them, you use the word communitarian, have left-wing forms of communitarianism as well. But it's also the case that that on the so-called right, that the right wing and some forms of conservatism have now for a couple of centuries been dissatisfied with or suspicious of the liberal package. They think it's too rationalistic, and that causes problems for traditional religion. Or it's too individualistic, and that causes problems from their perspective for the family, or believing in certain traditions that they think are important, that it's corrosive of various traditions as well. Or that they think it's, instead of prizing local communities, the conservatives that traditionally are more in favor of my group, perhaps my ethnic group and so forth, that it becomes much more globalistic, it becomes much more cosmopolitan. I don't like the politics that the liberal world is bringing about, and so they will be critical of it. And what we have found, particularly in the last generation, is as liberalism has been increasingly under attack from the left, and it has been weakened institutionally by those attacks on the left, many on the right then want to say, well, if it's the case that liberalism is on its way out, and we're somewhat sympathetic to that, but at the same time, we don't like what the leftists are wanting to replace that with. What we need to do is go post-liberal, but in a more right-wing or conservative direction. And so I'm putting those in quotation marks just to flag that those are a big tent, and we need to unpack and get more precise about all of those. So you do mention people like Michael Sandel, going back half a generation now, Alistair MacIntyre going back a generation or now, and then the current generation of people like Yoram Hazony, and then some other people who are kind of Christian nationalists or integralists of various sort. They are trying to revive and rework that broadly right-wing conservative territory in a post-liberal direction. And I think you're right to say that one significant component of that is the communitarian element.
Okay, so I want to ask you about something that seems to me to be the case when I listen to a lot who call themselves post-liberals. So there are several patterns that seem to me to be emerging. So first of all, it seems to me that they do not distinguish between the classical strand of the tradition, classical liberalism, and what is usually called modern liberalism, that personally I don't like calling it liberalism so much, the tradition of the later John Stuart Mill, John Rawls, and Ronald Dworkin, and possibly Will Kimlicker. And for some reason, it seems to me that they mostly attack this idea of modern liberalism. And when you tell them that that's not what the classical liberal tradition is all about, they somehow say that, well, it has to somehow lead into this because liberalism says that we are free and equal. When you ask them what it means to be free and equal, they sort of never define. They just leave it hanging there. They just say liberalism tells us free and equal. And I see this regularly. And I have heard you talking about a conservative mythos of liberalism. Would you care to tell us a bit about what this is? Because it seems to me that particularly the classical version of the tradition, is routinely represented by post-liberals as just following money, and they routinely forget the political aspect of that tradition. They seem to be completely unaware of the Republican strand of it, and also you could say of some monarchist element within the tradition that aren't absolute in form. And also they seem to me to be completely oblivious frequently of the distinction between the classical and the modern version, where you see that the classical version is talking about equality of civil rights. It's that includes a strong component of property rights within it, and it is talking primarily about the relationship between the individual and the state, and they sort of just try to have a one-size-fits-all conception of all of it. What would you say about this?
Well, what I would say is that is a very rich and difficult question, partly because what we then have to do is to talk about what happened to classical liberalism as it was first conceived in the 1600s, institutionalized in the 1700s, and continued to evolve in the 1800s. And then what we now take certain conservative right-wing, right, or post-liberal thinkers' understanding of how that history went. So we would have to talk about both of those. But I think you're right. The first important thing is to say, to get clear on the distinction between how liberalism has been used classically and still is used. That classical liberal tradition is still with us, and a significant number of people use liberalism that way. And then a different use of the word liberal that evolved in the early part of the 20th century and a significant number of people still use. So one of the debates we have right now is between those who want to say, here's what liberalism, and it is continuing to evolve now as a tradition, but it has its integrity and it needs to be distinguished from this variation. And we'll come back to what that variation is that is also trying to use that same liberal word, versus those who want to say, we see ourselves as inheritors of this classical liberal tradition that has now evolved into something that is significantly different from that classically liberal tradition, even though it retains some of the classical liberal elements as well. And I don't want this just to be a fight about words, but to draw our attention to the substantial issues underneath. So let's take up that first distinction. So the classically liberal tradition was quite robust. It was, definitely part and saying that what we should do is be liberal economically. Individuals, human beings should be individuals. They should not be members of a caste. Remember that liberalism came out of a rejection of feudalism, that people are born into a place in the hierarchy, and what you can do with your life is dictated by your place in the hierarchy, and things are largely static. Individuals should be free agents economically to go into any line of work that they want, and to both as producers and as consumers and as traders. So liberalism does then mean in part of it that we are going to be some sort of free market capitalists in our economics. It also, though, was equally committed to liberalism in the political sphere, that people should be free agents, that they should be self-governing, and that their agency with respect to whatever powers are delegated to government to rule them in some respect has to come from the individual citizens themselves, that individual citizens are free to enter into the political debates, to run for office, and so that we have a kind of democratic political set of institutions that are part and parcel of the liberal project. But at the same time, there are limits to what political systems can do. Individuals are the ones who fundamentally have rights. Those rights are absolute or something close to that, and they are protected in some sort of a constitution, and that's the more republican element of it. So liberalism is both a political project and it is an economic project. But also the liberalism applies to religion. It's up to you to make your own mind up with respect to religion and to so to speak, save your own soul and join whatever institutions you think are going to help you with that. But also, if you don't like the given religious institutions, you are free to leave them. You're even free to start your own religious institutions. You are a free agent, again, when it comes to liberalism. It was also with, so we have a whole bunch of then non-economic directly and non-political elements as well. People should be free thinking with respect to their romantic lives. People should be free thinking with respect to science. Anybody can become a scientist as well. So robust free speech and free thinking in those institutions as well. The great battle against slavery was launched by the modern liberals. We need to free all of the slaves. They should have the exact same freedoms. The same thing with respect to women. Women shouldn't be second or third class. They also are individuals with their own minds. They should be self-governing individuals in all areas of their lives as well. So what you then have is classical liberalism, as we now call it, was a robust program that was basically liberal across the board. And that was the one that transformed the modern world in the 1800s and on into the 1900s. Now, what we call modern liberalism is a compromise philosophy. It's an attempt to forge a hybrid. And the hybrid comes out of looking at what also happened in the modern world after the fall of feudalism. Once we get past the idea that we're going to have this hierarchical society, kings and nobles, and even our religion is going to be hierarchically based and so forth, and everybody knowing their place in society and so forth, we're going to explode the feudal hierarchical understanding of the world. What are we going to replace that with? And there was a significant school of thinkers and activists who said, we don't like the liberal model. Instead, what we want is to emphasize a more collective, and in many cases, a more authoritarian, collective, egalitarian approach to philosophy. And so we then have a tradition that is anti-liberal from the get-go, coming out of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Fichte, Hegel, Marx, and other thinkers in the march of history of philosophy as we go on here. The important point about this is that all of these people are anti-feudal, but they are also anti-liberal. And in many cases, what they will say is that the new ideal society is going to be some sort of collectivized, communitarian, it might be class-based, it might be more tribally based, and that's Marx versus Rousseau and so forth, but it is definitely not going to be liberal, and it's not going to be individualistic, it's not going to be capitalistic, it's not going to be democratic in that classically liberal sense as well. So the story of the rise of what we now call the left, and the left portraying itself as a new modern ideal that we should strive for, became very popular by the time we get to the late 1800s and on into the 1900s. So what intelligent, well-meaning young people in the Western world are confronted with by the time we get, say, to the turn of the 20th century is to say, I understand this liberal individualistic approach, and I can see the appeal of many elements of that, but at the same time, I also see the appeal of a more collectivized, communitarian, socialistic approach. And so what we call so-called modern liberals are people who want to say, we believe with the classical liberals on certain kinds of freedoms. Women should be free. We shouldn't have slavery anymore. We should have certain kinds of civil rights, and we should have significant amounts of participation by citizens in the political process and so on. So we are agreeing with the traditional classical liberals on all of that. But on the economic front, we are much more committed to the idea of the left and seeing the assets as belonging to the community, that those should be distributed more equally among the community, and or that the government should be significantly involved in managing the economy in various directions and making sure that everybody is looked after in various ways. So what we call so-called modern liberalism then is a hybrid of classical liberalism and a kind of communitarian socialism. It agrees in varying degrees with the economic program, but not with the but it agrees with these people over here on the civil rights kind of program. Now, that then I think is the first important clarification. So what we then have had mostly in the 20th century was people who wanted to say, we need to be individualists, we need to be capitalists, we need to be free market, we need to be democratic republicans, freedom of religion, et cetera, in a robust way. Then we have the people who are strongly committed to various types of communitarian socialism, communism, and the most dominant form of that was quite authoritarian. And then people in the middle who want to kind of split the difference in various ways or forge a compromise version of them. And that was sometimes called modern liberalism in high academics. By the time we get to the political space, it was usually called the third way. So just to go back one generation, Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, for example, then the president of the United States and the prime minister of Great Britain, at the collapse of the Soviet Union. So finally, the Cold War, some sort of liberalism seems to have won against this socialism. But immediately at that point, they were very quick to say, as good kind of modern liberalism compromise, well, yes, obviously socialism went too far and it's a failure, but we don't want to be too classically liberal. We want a third way that's going to combine the best of both worlds. And so they are offering a kind of compromise version. Now, I want to say that's partly just a conceptual distinction that we are making here. The issue of whether we should be consistently liberal, consistently socialist, collectivist, or whether we should try to work out some sort of compromise, that's been the debate for the last generation.
Okay, I have two more questions. Question number one is, why do you think the Russian philosopher Dugin appeals to many people who claim to be post-liberals, especially on the right?
Well, Dugin is clearly a post-liberal. I don't know how much your audience is familiar with the work of Alexander Dugin. Some of the suspicions are that he is Putin's brain. I think that's a little bit overstated. But the question is, from the Russian intellectual perspective, what is Russia going to do over the course of the last generation after the fall of the Soviet Union? And what Dugin has been very successful at is marketing a philosophy that has significant elements of a good reading of history that wants to say, if we look at the history of the 20th century, the history of the 20th century came down to three philosophies that were abstractly realized and then instantiated in political reality. And that in addition to this three-way philosophical intellectual battle, we also had a three-way physical battle, often spilling out into war. Those three ideologies were liberalism, by which he means, Western, democratic, capitalistic, republican, individualistic, pro-science, et cetera, basically the Western world, and the United States as the most prominent exponent of that philosophy. The second one was communism or socialistic or international socialism coming out of Marx, Lenin, Stalin, and so forth. And that was hugely prominent with the Soviet Union as the leading exemplar of that. And certainly communist China under Mao is an important part of that. So we have that story of those two. But also there was the fascist approach. And the fascist approach first launched by Mussolini in Italy, and then in a kind of a sibling or close cousin variation, the National Socialists in Germany, led by Adolf Hitler. So Dugin's account of the 20th century, and I think this is by and large right at a certain level of abstraction, is to say it was liberalism versus fascism versus socialism, or socialism in the communistic form. And so what we then did was we took all of those theories, we put them into practice experimentally, and one of the things that comes out in the experiment is then a collision between these models of organizing society. And fascism was largely discredited by the time we get to the middle part of the 20th century. By the time we get to the end of the 20th century, communistic socialism has been discredited. And so it seems like the only thing left standing is some sort of liberalism on the Western model. And certainly many people in the West wanted to say, in effect, we have reached the kind of the end of history, to borrow Fukuyama's phrase, that what we have learned as a result of both theory and practice is that some sort of liberalism is the future, and it's only a matter of time until the rest of the world gets on board and we all become kind of liberal, democratic, republican, capitalist at some point. Now, Dugin, though, as a philosopher, at this point, he is in his 30s, and so he has matured as an intellectual, and he hates liberalism, and he hates all of the elements of illiberalism all the way down. And he is intelligent and articulate at being able to recognize and verbalize what the elements of the liberal package are. And what he hates, and the language is not too strong here, in the 1990s, is that liberalism seems to be the victor. So what he wants is to try to find some way to say there's going to be another alternative for the future, and for Russia in particular, that is not going to be liberal. What he does in the 1990s, by the time we get to the late 1990s, is say what we need to do is revive fascism. And he makes no bones about it, that it clearly is just traditional, straight up fascism. Mussolini was great. Hitler and the Nazis were great. Their only problem was that they compromised too much with the liberals, with the capitalists and so forth. And they introduced a virus into the noble purity of fascism, and that's why they failed. So by the time we get to the late 1990s, Dugin is arguing that we need to take ethnicity seriously. We need to see individuals not as having rights, and that we're going to have some sort of scientific, technological utopia in the future, but rather we are communitarian, we are ethnic, we have our religion, we have our language. And the idea that somehow our ethnicity and our nation is special and its job is to lead the world forward, just like Mussolini and the and Hitler and the other fascists thought so. So we basically take the fascist program and we translate it and customize it for the Russian context. Now, what Dugin does is evolves some over the course of the next decade. And he stops talking fascistically, or at least using the language of fascism more explicitly. And he also broadens his understanding of the place of Russia in the world, that Russia, of course, is going to be the leading nation, but Russia is also going to be more expansionistic, and it's going to include all of the geographically neighboring areas, and they will then be unified into a kind of pan-Eurasian political ethnic mass that will then take the world further into the future. So that's Putin's positive program, and it is communitarian, it is ethnically focused, it is deeply religious. He wants to incorporate kind of Russian Orthodox. It's not clear that he actually believes, but he certainly sees it, that religion as an important cultural force. And to come now directly to your question about why he is attractive to people on the post-liberal right, so to speak, is that he mounts many of the same criticisms of Western liberalism that people on the post-liberal right mount with respect to liberalism. That it's too rationalistic, it's too individualistic, it leads to all kinds of immoralities, it's corrosive of certain fundamental institutions, moral institutions, political institutions, religious institutions that they think are important. And so from that perspective, liberalism, because it elevates the individual and it elevates freedom, it's just going to end up in all kinds of perversions, all kinds of nihilisms, and a collapsing society. And so from their perspective, their critiques of liberalisms and Dugin's critiques of liberalism are strongly overlapping.
Right. And I think we come to the last question, which I want to contextualize a bit. So what is the proper relation between individualism and care for society? Now, a lot of people think that individualism is inherently asocial. I think that this is a mistake. Individualism is precisely a concern about how to coexist. Robinson Crusoe would not care about individual rights. There would be no one to violate them in an island. So the question becomes, number one, what is individualism? And number two, whether individualism and a kind of support for one's society and for one's culture that could be seen as grounding the institutions that ground political and economic freedom be. What should the relation be between them?
Yeah, again, another great question and a very rich question. I think you're exactly right. You know, individualism is a philosophy that wants to say, if you want to have a good society, then you need to take the individual seriously, fundamentally, and treat with a sacrosanct evaluation. So the idea of individual versus society, it comes from an alien philosophical perspective that wants to say we need to valorize the society in some sense, and we see individuals as bad, as sinful, as self-destructive, as other destructive. It's a very pessimistic understanding, typically, of human nature, that if you see individuals that way and you have certain social values, then you will say it's the individual versus society. And what we need to do is tame the individual or otherwise control the individual so that we can achieve certain social values. Now, the proper and I think healthy way of understanding the relationship between the individual and society is to say the societies are made up of individuals. The society is not an organism. In many cases, in strong forms, the socialists, this is small s, socialists will say that individuals really are elements of an organism. Society is an organism, and that your job is just to be a cell that cannot exist apart from the larger organism, and that you're to perform a delimited function in the organism as a whole. So the individual wants to say no. First and foremost, we are individuals ontologically. We are separate physically and then cognitively. And this is where philosophy and epistemological issues become very important. That part of being an individual is to have one's own mind, that you perceive the world, you have your memories, you organize your understanding of the world in a certain way, and that you are in charge of that process. You can, of course, learn a huge amount from other people, but it's always individuals who need to do that processing and say, yes, I agree, and internalize that into their intellectual framework, and I'm going to act on the basis of that. So individuals are ontologically real, that they exist. They're not just fragments of some larger social organism. They have cognitive agency, they have behavioral agency. As a result of that, individuals are moral agents. We should hold them responsible for their thinking, hold them responsible for their agency against various forms of, again, small s, socializing that wants to say, no, the individual is not controlled because individuals are just socialized by forces beyond their control and they are just avatars acting on the basis of various kinds of social agendas. So the individualist then starts at a very fundamental philosophical level. Individuals are real metaphysically. They have cognitive agency. They have behavioral agency. They have moral agency. And so if we are concerned with treating human beings properly, we first have to recognize them as individuals. Now, individuals do form, importantly, into social units. So, you know, we can start one way and say, you know, a man and a woman, they start off as individuals, but they recognize certain things about each other. They form positive judgments about each other, and they decide that they're going to come together. They say first as boyfriend, girlfriend, as, say, husband and wife, that they are going to form a social unit. And the individualist wants to say, if it's going to be a healthy relationship or a healthy marriage, it has to be one that respects both individuals as individuals who are making a voluntary choice and a voluntary commitment that they now jointly are going to make say a new unit, a new social unit. They will say start a family. And so the new baby, an infant, will come into the world. And it is a developmental process, but that baby is going to grow to have, has its own body, has its own mind, becomes an agent. And the job of the parents is to foster this individual now in the context of a healthy social unit so that it can grow up to be a functioning individual in other social units. Part of it is to say that you're going to take responsibility as an individual for your economic life. I recognize that values that I'm going to consume need to be produced in the world. So I need to acquire some knowledge and some skills so that I can be a productive person and support myself in the world. And that I'm not going to shift that responsibility off to say, oh no, other people are responsible for looking after me. So I'm going to be economically an individual agent. I'm not going to be a freeloader. I'm not going to be a parasite in various forms as well. And so we can then say, well, in the economic sphere, what does individualism mean? Well, I make some stuff. I've been productive. You have been productive as an individual. We both have been productive individuals. That's good. But again, we recognize I've got something you want. You have something I want. We spot the potential for a trade and that I'm going to respect you as an individual, that you need to get from this trade what you need. But you also are going to respect me as an individual to get what I need from this trade. We will negotiate. We will make a trade. We will shake hands in a way that's going to be mutually beneficial. And that's then not the basis of a family life, but that's now the basis of doing business. And the individualists want to say, look, if you want to have moral business and you want to have healthy business, business is a kind of socializing, but it has to be based on respecting individuals as free agents in the economic sphere. Same thing we want to say with respect to religion. Religion should not be a matter of conditioning people from an early age or using various coercive threats to get them to conform behaviorally to your religion. Religion is something about beliefs and behaviors and what you are going to think about the fate of your soul or your value framework and so on. That the individualists want to say, yes, we can learn from each other about religion. We can have debates about religion. We can join into religious institutions and so on. But that has to be on the basis of individuals thinking for themselves, finding like-minded individuals, and then forming institutions or forming various kinds of social relationships with people that they as individuals judge to be so. So if you want religion to be done healthily, it has to be done on the basis of individualism. So the individualist then from this perspective wants to say proper sociability is on an individualistic basis. There's no disharmony or conflict there.
So is it safe to conclude that people who advocate for individualism care for a community in a qualified sense? And in that case, communitarians don't have a monopoly on caring about a community. Would you say that this is safe to conclude?
Yes. So communitarians in many cases are genuine, say that we care about communal values. And they will then have a hard time conceptually understanding how individualists could also care about community values, because from their perspective, the individual is some sort of antisocial being. And so it's just a non-starter from their perspective. So I think the first intellectual step is to say that many communitarians and many individualists will say, yes, we care about social values. We want healthy families, healthy businesses, healthy political systems. So they have the same end, so to speak, but they disagree fundamentally on the means to getting there. Now, at the same time, I do want to say that there are many communitarians who I don't really think caring about healthy communal values is what's really going on. There's some sort of other agenda at work there. And so in that case, it's not only about means, it's also about the ends.
Excellent. So thank you very much, Professor Hicks, for this interview. And I hope...
Yeah, really great and rich questions. And the time flew by. Exactly. I look forward to seeing it published, Celios.
Thank you very much. And I hope to you, the members of our audience, I hope you enjoyed this. And thank you very much and see you next time. Goodbye.
COTA just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your COTA fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with COTA. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.